Good day, citizens. Good day, Thomas Jefferson Hour podcast listeners. And thank you, Thomas Jefferson Hour 1776 Club supporters. We have gained more supporters in the past couple of weeks, and we haven't even pitched it. So I have to say thank you. We keep track of that, and we so appreciate it.
Speaking of pitch, let me say that the Lewis and Clark Cultural Tour is filling up for the summer, the 18th through the 27th of July. People can go to the website, jeffersonhour.com. Mm-hmm. Or my site, clayjenkinson.com.
Oh, and there's a nifty little TV thing on Facebook they can see.
So do come on this trip. It's the Wendover hike. It's 3 days on the White Cliffs section of the Missouri in canoes.
Essentially, people fly into Missoula, and then they're taken by the hand, and they get to
They're outfitters. Down. Your tents are set up.
It's not like you're paddling upstream.
There's no sweat, no strain. It's all joy. And so that's
and
the summer.
And good food.
Wonderful food.
And
18
good friends.
Through 27. It's my favorite week of
change
the year.
Change your life.
And it does change my life. It changes other people's lives. And the number one question I get is, where's Swenson?
I
said he can't swim.
Somebody, well, that's not true.
I know.
I have my one-mile merit badge.
Becky could try to drown you, too.
The truth is, and you'll hear in the show, somebody's got to weed your garden for you.
Day. I look forward to that day, my friend. Speaking of gardens, there are two types of people in this world, David.
Uh-huh.
Or Jefferson Hour listeners, let's put it that way. Those who can't wait for more gardening patter and those who say, enough already on gardens. But this week, brace yourself.
Yeah.
It's garden.
We've been good. We've been saving it up.
We had the chance to talk with Pat Brodowski, the head gardener at Monticello. She's an extraordinary woman. She was talking from the garden, from the 1,000-foot terrace on the south wall, the south face of the mountain. And it was an absolutely delightful conversation.
It was great.
There were some interns or volunteers, maybe guests at Monticello,
six children
in the little
peas.
South Pavilion. Yeah, so they're in there planting their peas in the little cups.
Yeah.
What a thing to do. What a way to create a Jeffersonian.
So both of us were just sitting through the whole interview, envying her, she gets to do.
She has the greatest job in the world. She gets to manage 1,000, how deep is it? It's like 24 feet deep, I think.
My understanding is it's 9 squares that are 100 feet by 150 feet, except one of the squares is only 92 feet, which...
That breaks the Jeffersonian order.
It should have driven him nuts. I don't know what happened.
I wonder what happened.
There must be a reason.
There's obviously a reason, because this is one of the most orderly men who ever lived.
Uh-huh.
Another insight that she had, which we kind of brushed over, but it was a great insight. I'm not sure I agree with her, but she said that famous chart that Jefferson had in the White House of when different things are available at different greengrocers, she said that really wasn't about feeding people at the White House. That was about thinking of what will grow at Monticello and how's it different from the District of Columbia.
Well, that kind of makes sense to me.
It does. I want to find out more about that, because I've always assumed it was his purchasing chart.
Yeah.
She's saying, not really. It's more about
Careful,
science.
We're going to go off the edge again. Garden, garden, garden.
It is. You know, I've started my garden.
Folks,
you've started your
one.
Garden, right?
I have. It's the 14th of April, and I have lettuce and spinach out of the ground.
I have some volunteer garlic from last year.
I have about 60 tomato little 3-inch
They're
pots.
All in your house.
Yeah, I have some for you.
When will you transfer?
To what?
Outside.
Oh, weeks.
After Memorial Day for me.
Yeah, maybe. But I do have, we talk about the jomatoes, the Joe Cocker tomatoes.
You've done that.
I have. You gave me 6 seeds, 4 of them
came
up.
I want one plant. And then
so.
I want, this, you know, I was so bad about this last year because I'm always, you know, I travel all the time.
Yeah.
But that's no excuse, I'm sure. But I didn't label things well enough. So when I plant that Joe Cocker tomato, I want to know which one it is come August.
Garden books.
Yeah, you got to keep an accurate garden book. But you know what I want?
I was looking in preparation for the show. I was looking through Peter Hatch's book last night and looking at Jefferson's entry when he was 23 years old. You know, his garden entries, and then I'm looking at my little paper notebook with
perfect handwriting.
Pencils. Yeah, and it made me think. You know, I could probably do a little bit better job, but keeping a garden book is the closest thing I'll ever do to self-journaling, and it's wonderful.
This book, Peter J. Hatch, A Rich Spot of Earth from a Letter that Jefferson Wrote to Charles Wilson Peel in 1811, A Rich Spot of Earth, Thomas Jefferson's Revolutionary Guard at Monticello. It's a coffee table book. It's the number one book to have if you want to be a Jeffersonian gardener.
Before we go to the show, I will say that you had a brilliant essay this week about gardening, and you quote that phrase in there, so...
No occupation is so delightful to me.
If you can't stand listening to all the garden talk, those of you who don't like it.
But you'll like Pat better than you like us.
Fast forward to the end and don't miss Clay's essay this week.
Which we'll post in other ways, too. Go to our website, jeffersonhour.com. If you'd like to become a 1776 Club member, now would be a great time for that. If you'd like to contribute to the Jefferson Hour, we love that. And if you'd like to come on the Lewis and Clark Cultural Tour, the 18th through the 27th of July, 2017, now's the time to contact my drowning partner, Becky. You can do that by going to our website, jeffersonhour.com.
You can find it all at jeffersonhour.com.
Hey, thanks for listening,
everyone.
All that
and more, and thanks, Graham.
This week, Gardening Out of Character.
Good day, citizens, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with or about President Thomas Jefferson. I'm your host, David Swenson, and seated across from me is the creator of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. And Clay, we have a very special conversation on the Thomas Jefferson Hour this week.
We had the chance to talk with our friend Pat Brodowski, who is the gardener at Thomas Jefferson's Monticello. And she's an old, dear friend of mine. We've done some work together. She's an amazing woman. I think she says today, David, that she has worked up 13 or 14 different crafts, not including gardening.
Uh-huh.
So she's one of those people who has capacities in all sorts of arenas in life, particularly early National American life. And what a delightful person she is.
And you and I are amateur gardeners.
Especially me as well.
But we have a great love for it, and we understand when Jefferson says, if you put your hands in the soil, we know what that means. You know, a lot of listeners over the years have heard that and sent us photographs of potted tomatoes on their balconies. And
we want to hear about it.
We are amateurs. Pat Brodowski is not.
She knows what she's
doing. She knows what she's doing.
This is a wonderful opportunity. We've been wanting to do this for a long time, to check in with the gardener at Thomas Jefferson's Monticello.
And we have her on the line now.
Hey, Pat, it's Clay and David. How are you?
Marvelous.
And it is a great time to be talking with you, Pat, because it is the weekend of Thomas Jefferson's birthday.
Right. It was such a fantastic day yesterday. Of course, we have a cake, but in the Fife and Drum Corps. But when Alice Waters gave a very impassioned speech on the lawn about agrarian life and how small farms are the answer to the future, it was really touching. And that's a free morning. Every birthday for Jefferson is a free day on the mountain.
Pat, for our listeners, can you kind of give an overview of where you are, what you're seeing, and what's going on today?
Yes, I'm at the Garden Pavilion. It's the center part of the garden.
So you're in Thomas Jefferson's garden, and explain how the terrace was created.
Well, he chose a mountain to live on, and so he started leveling a place for the house, then a terrace for the slave workers to work, and then another terrace below that for the vegetable garden, and a terrace below that for the fruit. So it all faces south. And we have this enormous 1,000-foot garden, and it faces almost exactly south. And so we have this enormous day of sunshine, and we have, you know, the southern exposure. It's very warm, probably about 10 degrees warmer here than anywhere else. And it's a fantastic location for garden. He had hired seven enslaved workers, I can't really say hire, but he had them brought here, and they spent 3 years carving off the slope and moving the earth, using gunpowder to blow up the rocks, and building a retaining wall. In some places, I think it's 15 feet up. That was so when he retired, he could come and plant everything that he could find, every variety of every plant that was available at the time. And his decision was to figure out the two best of each one. And so we now have a list of about 400 vegetables and herbs. I try to grow everything I can find in it from his lifetime in the same year. So we have about 250 varieties of things. It's a lot of fun.
When I see the magnificent gardens at Monticello, I think this would be hard work for modern industrial equipment with bulldozers and so on. This is an enormous earth-moving project.
Oh, enormous. Right, with, a pick, a wagon. He had a drawing for the garden, which we call the olatory, and we had an archaeology dig here on the bank, and our garden bank is 45-degree angle, and when we looked at his drawings, he's talking about a much more vertical, steep slope in step that he can put thorny bushes on, I think, to keep animals out. And then, actually, with the archaeology, we actually found the original clay bank, and it was 70 degrees vertical, so it's a sheer wall, and then the garden. And so at one point, he did come out to check the work, they're proceeding, and they said, oh, we're done, we've leveled this terrace. It's actually in three levels because it's wrapping around a mountain. And Fred put a shovel in the ground. Punk, punk, well, he says, I need 18 inches of soil depth, you know. I have to be, the roots have to go somewhere. So he said, now we'll bring up manure. So that's from Milton, which from here you can't really see. It's up 3 miles and 600 feet below this level. So he had 70 wagon loads of manure brought up to start rebuilding the soil. So it was quite a phenomenal thing. And his daughter was left in charge a lot of times to tend the garden, and he had a number of gardeners that were trained to grow vegetables and flowers.
So when you're out there working in the garden, I've seen you there, and it's a beautiful day, and you're planting or weeding or whatever it is you're doing, there must be times when you find yourself reflecting that this thing was made possible by people who weren't free. Does that in any way damage your joy or your respect or your delight at being in Jefferson's garden?
A number of slaves had been here for 4 or 5 generations, and it was the way of life. The idea of freedom, I'm not sure when that really took root here. Some of the slaves who eventually were freed, or, you know, after Jefferson, the families, I mean, there's a story, I think it's, I'm trying to remember the name, but he went off and became a minister in, I think, Ohio. And he turned 85, and the congregation said, what would you like to do? And he said, I would like to return to Monticello, because that was home to me, and I want to see what it's like. And actually, he came through, you know, the front door, and makes a big story about that. But I have a feeling that you didn't think so much about getting away unless there was some issue. And I think there was some, very, very rarely, some kind of altercation between slaves, and some would be sent away as a message. I don't see a lot of that kind of abusive nature. It's just, when you're employed by a job, you know, you're kind of bonded to that job. So even today, right? So, I might have a real Pollyanna view of slavery, but I'm not seeing that their talents weren't being brought to life here. And there are certain laws. You weren't supposed to learn to read or write, but he communicated with them with reading and writing. And so somewhere things were letting them, you know, learn more and do more. They all had gardens. They sold produce to the household every Sunday. And they had, you know, earned money that way. They most likely had credit at the store in town, get a pass to go down and buy the things you wanted. And they dig up the artifacts from Mulberry Row or any of the enslaved dwellings out in the woods or wherever, which is the woods now. The pottery and things are the same as Jefferson had in his household. So it's not a demeaned life that I can see.
All right, let me change the subject. I want to ask a question that's I've been thinking about for, I suppose, now for 30 years. How much time did our man Thomas Jefferson actually spend in the garden with his hands in the earth?
Yeah, that's the only quote we know that I know so far is that I think it was a Granger who left a record of his time here. And he did say that Mr. Jefferson came down in the right cool of the evening for about a half an hour to the garden. And so I don't know if that was when he was elderly. Certainly wasn't when he was younger, because he had a lot, I think, of hands-on when he was younger. He did hire up a lot of people. He had 10 Italian gardeners.
So 1,000 feet and 24 squares. I mean, is it fair to say that most of the gardening work inevitably would have been done by people other than Jefferson himself?
Oh, yes. Right. So today, I'm the gardener, and there's a full-time gardener in each garden, one for flowers, one for vegetables, one for fruit, and one for native plants. And we have a swing gardener who helps all four. So I have a person that helps me significantly and part of the time. So And then, so what I say is I try to keep up with Jefferson's gardener, Wormley Hughes, who was a gardener here for many years. So once you get something in the ground, it keeps growing. So you just have to keep the weeds out.
Let me ask a really impossible question. So in the year from, let's just say, January 1st until Christmas, so you're preparing the soil, planting the soil, weeding, early harvest, later harvest, etc. What's the part for you personally, Pat, that's most satisfying in the whole garden year?
What do I like the best? Well, I really get involved. You know, you end up loving each plant. You end up loving all the peas and each tendril, and then it gets cabbages. I must have 1,000 pictures of cabbages. I love when things flower. It's just an endless cycle of things that you love and appreciate. You know, right now we've got cabbage flowering, which I think is delightful because it's an endless panorama of beauty down here. And then we have the vista from this terrace of 45 miles of blue, horizon with trees and sky. And it's just, every day is beautiful down here. So, and people say, do you have a favorite vegetable? And I don't know. I like asparagus. I like peas. I like artichokes. Like everything.
Well, there was a slightly evasive answer, but I certainly get the sense.
Well, some of the best parts of being a gardener here at Monticello, which is thronged with visitors, is when they become inspired. And that is, when they say, oh, that's a wonderful idea. Or, oh, I want to grow this. And it's just a miracle. They come down and think, that a vegetable is either a pepper or a tomato in the garden. And they say, wow, a kale? I never thought I could grow that. Or, is this an artichoke? Why is it so huge? Or cauliflower? You get only that much for all of these leaves? That's terrific. And when they get, right now we have the twig fences up to the peas. So I get to illustrate, teach them how to weave twigs so the peas can climb. And, that's always a lot of fun. So just getting people enthused about gardening, that's probably the best thing.
We are talking with the great Pat Bradowski, gardener at Monticello, my good friend. We've had lots of interaction and we'll have lots more. She's actually, you can hear a little of the wind noise. She's actually in the gardens, the 1,000-foot terrace gardens at Monticello at this moment, which is Good Friday 2017. And you're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. When we come back, I have a whole series of questions, as I know David Swenson does too. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Jefferson Hour. This is Clay Jenkinson with the semi-permanent guest host of the Jefferson Hour, David Swenson, sitting across from me. We're inside. We are envious, Pat. You are outside on a beautiful, apparently slightly windy day at Monticello.
Yes.
Of the people that come to Monticello on a weekend like this, how many come down into the garden itself and putter around and ask questions?
Everyone comes to the garden. So, we'll probably have maybe 2,500, 3,000 people today. So they all come. And they usually all want to talk to the gardeners, too. We do have garden ambassadors, our master gardeners, and some volunteers actually hang out in the garden to answer questions. Everyone wants to know what happened to the produce. If anything interesting comes up, then they say, you've got to go talk to Pat. So that's really fun for me. We've got, 10 people doing a scavenger hunt here to the right. You've got and such, six kids planting peas inside the pavilion. It's really, really a cool day to be here.
So David Swenson and I both have gardens here in North Dakota, as you know. His is a little smaller, mine's a little larger. He takes a little bit better care of his. But it's Easter. It's Good Friday when we record this, the 14th of April, the day after Thomas Jefferson's birthday. I'm tilling, and you could plant a few things now around Easter time, but really we don't plant tomatoes or anything that we really don't want to freeze until Memorial Day. What's the growing season at Monticello?
Well, if we don't start in February, we pretty much miss the spring season. So, like, we put in all the peas on Lincoln's birthday, and we do that even if the ground is frozen. Even if we have snow, we make a channel and get the peas in, and they'll start to germinate. One time I grew peas in January, they still didn't pop up out of the ground until, you know, like the second week of February or third week of February, because the roots went 12 inches down. But our frost layer is about a quarter of an inch. So I feel very guilty because I grew up in upstate New York, and we didn't have growing seasons like this.
Pat, you talked about peas and Lincoln's birthday. Do you still do the annual pea contest with your neighbors?
What happens here in Charlottesville, every public school has a garden. And the third grade program is really part of that incentive. And they have a contest between the schools for which school can grow the earliest pea. It's really fun.
For our listeners who may not know, can you tell the story of the pea contest?
Jefferson got many seeds. And so he shared his seeds with George Divers at Farmington. And that's kind of like a plan B. And it's a different climate down there in Charlottesville. If something didn't work for Jefferson, George would probably have it and be able to sustain that variety. So the peas were shared, and George was so proud that he could grow peas and have the earliest peas chilled out on a dish. And so they had a contest, and who can have the earliest dish of peas? And George won year after year and would put on a fabulous dinner for them to all to celebrate, look at the first English peas. And then one year, Jefferson's peas were earlier. And then he said to Martha, well, George has had such a wonderful time putting on this wonderful dinner. Let's not tell him that our peas are earlier, and we'll just, you know, have dinner at his house and congratulate him. So that's the pea contest.
So Jefferson threw the fight. He went down, he threw the fight.
Yeah, it's very honorable, you know?
It's generous. It's typical Jefferson generosity of spirit. There's no question about that. Here's David.
Good to talk with you. Thanks so much for joining us today. You mentioned earlier the number of overseers, garden overseers that Jefferson had, and then in passing you mentioned the name Wormley Hughes, who I find just a fascinating character. Can you tell us more about him?
Yes. So I'm fascinated by who the gardeners might have been. And if you were a gardener that could hire a gardener, you would hire a Scottish gardener. So Jefferson hired Robert Bailey. He was Scottish. And he was here in 1794, and he was still directing some work in 1802. Scottish gardeners got educated in the wintertime for 3 months, so they knew how to read and write and keep mathematical figures. So Robert Bailey taught Wormley Hughes. He was a nail boy. He was born here, and he became a nail boy. And then he was doing road work, and he cared for the horses. And then he became the head gardener because Jefferson asked him to, you know, train with Robert Bailey. And so he was one of the most trusted servants. Jefferson wrote that he was the head gardener and one of the most trusted servants on the plantation. And he prepared the beds. He sowed the seeds, he prepared the seeds and plants to be shipped to Europe, to other friends who were collecting things that Jefferson had. And then he also was the person to put the manure on the garden, the 1,000-foot-long garden. And it says a good wagon load of dung every 5 yards would be about 60 and 70 loads for the first year. So that was Wormley's task, probably in January. And he became, he was freed by Jefferson's daughter, Martha. And then the descendants became farmers, gardeners, blacksmiths, archivists. And the phrases that everyone remembers about Wormley is that Wormley will do it. He knows where everything is. And then Wormley's expression, no matter what happened, Wormley would say, I am in no wise discouraged. I will not be discouraged.
What things do you do that Jefferson couldn't do by way of tilling and chemicals and things that were out of his imagination?
Oh, we do have a rotavator on the tractor that we've used at times. We used to till quite a bit, especially when we put compost down in January, we till it in. And then we have a small push-behind tiller. Those, we can't use any tools after 10 a.m., so those are restricted. And then we have an underground irrigation system that we can plug into. Of course, we have to work that around visitation, too, so we can have like 2 hours at night, a couple hours in the morning. It's usually on the clock. Those are things we aren't even using the tiller, the rotavator this year. We felt it was compacting the soil. So I have a broad fork, which I love, and that is really breaking up the subsurface clay layer. And I would advise anyone to use a broad fork. It's a beautiful thing. It really loosens the soil.
What does it look like? What's a broad fork? What does it look like?
It's like a series of knife blades that are about 13, 14 inches long on a handle that's two handles. You can put your hand on each handle. You put your feet on top of the blade, and you stamp on it until the blades go in all the way to the soil. And then you rock back and forth, and then you finally rock it all the way down until the blades pop up, and these big chunks of soil pop up. And meanwhile, as you're rocking, it's breaking that subsurface. And so the 42 feet, I can do that in about a half an hour.
So what are you saying that this year, 2017, you are hand-tilling the entire garden?
We're doing one square at a time. And it's really significantly great.
What's an underground irrigation system?
Pipes underground, and we have sprinkler heads every 40 feet, and we can put a sprinkler that will shoot the water 50 feet. And so that will, one sprinkler will cover most of a square. So, we have six sprinklers, so we alternate, we can do four squares, five squares of the garden at once. And so we weed ahead of irrigating. If we do it in July when it gets to 110 out here, the irrigation is really helpful. And so we weed up five squares, irrigate them, and we can't walk on that for 3 days or we'll compact it. So that's a behind-the-scenes sort of thing.
And what about chemical applications?
No, don't say the word chemical.
So none.
No way.
You don't do it.
No.
Fantastic. Absolutely fantastic.
No. We have plants, and we have compost that we make ourselves, and we know it's pure because it's from our garden. And basically, for insect control, it's been fascinating. We have organic sprays, which we're trying not to use, by having more beneficial insects encouraged, and then by having these strategies. It's really complicated, but it's very fascinating, where you can have certain plants that trap the predator, and then you can annihilate it on a trap plant. So we have something. We have a little diabolical plan for every insect pest.
Fantastic. I'm going to turn it back to David, but I want to just say, I think you should take that tractor and the rotavator and give it to Mr. Monroe and go entirely hand labor there at Monticello.
Yeah, and you'll be happy to come down and help.
I would love to go down and help.
So would I, actually. A few years ago, Clay gave me some seeds that he purchased at Monticello, some tomato seeds. I think it's Castelluto Genovese. Am I saying that right? And that was about the same time I learned how to save seeds. So I got very fascinated with that. And in reading about Jefferson as a gardener, seed saving and seed sharing was kind of a subculture, a way of life for these guys.
Well, it was a necessary thing. There weren't all that many seed companies. And besides, if you start saving your own seeds from your own site, you are selecting the best ones. And so over time, those seeds will grow best for you. And so we have, lettuce that we've been saving for, 30 years. And you put it in the ground in a couple of days, it's up. And it's not like you have to struggle. If we buy a new seed from a company and try it here, it's usually a bit of a struggle to get it to really be productive. But after a couple of years saving seeds, then it goes gangbusters. So they become sort of regionalized, and maybe it's because you saved the best plants that did. The best from that seed. So the Castelluto tomato is interesting. Jefferson's tomatoes, he said he grew the Spanish tomato bigger than all the other ones, the Spanish tomato, and the dwarf tomato that runs around the ground like a weed. So that's all he gives us, is that tomato. So we have to look and find what tomatoes were available in his day and age. And we've grown the Genovese for a number of years, and does really well, obviously, because we keep saving the seeds over and over.
But you really don't have a record of the varieties that Jefferson grew. Tomatoes weren't very popular in his time, were they?
Certain cultures had the tomato. So Jefferson, when he went to Williamsburg, most likely met Dr. John de Siqueira, and I'm sure I'm murdering his name, but he was a Portuguese doctor at Williamsburg who was treating the mentally ill, and he advocated eating a tomato every day for eternal life. It's sort of like the apple story, right? So Jefferson credits that doctor with introducing the tomato to Virginia, and we're talking in the 1760s. So I think it depends on culture more than on history. I think in certain regions you had tomatoes, maybe because they grew well in Virginia, didn't grow very well in New England. Bernard McMahon, at the same time in 1800s, his catalog for eggplants and tomatoes lists them under annual flowers.
One of the things that amazes me about Jefferson is all the charts and record keeping. And I remember being at Monticello and seeing this side panel with all of these delicately labeled seed packets. When he was president, he did this chart of when vegetables became available during the growing season. Do you know through your own research, what was vegetable consumption like during those times? Was it much higher than, say, during our time?
I don't know how to compare. I bet they ate a lot more, though, considering the diets of most people today. But the idea that he was keeping a chart of when things arrived and left in the market, I don't think was really, maybe it's so he could supply the kitchen, but I really think it was he was trying to estimate when's the best planting date and how long would this season last, like in his own garden. If they can have asparagus at this date in Washington, why can't I? And I'm actually farther south, so it should be earlier. So I think he's really, and that's a brilliant thing for anyone who moves to a new area to do, is see what's in the market and think, oh, that took so many days to produce. I should start my seeds in that time frame. So the other thing he did was a lot of phenology, which in his journals, you know, he kept a journal for the garden, but he mentioned, you know, when certain flowers bloomed or when butterflies returned or birds. And all of those are, it's called phenology. Certain things are linked. Like right now, the red buds are all, it's a big pink froth in the woods. I think he was trying to link the natural occurrences to planting dates. And the other cool thing he did was he told his overseer of the garden to plant a thimble full of lettuce every Monday from February through September. And so we know today that lettuce will not germinate over 85 degrees. So he's having somebody plant lettuce in July every week and reporting whether it works or not. So what he does is establishes the parameters in which you can have lettuce germinating in the spring and in the fall. And he does that with so many plants. He keeps recording what fails, what works. It's not because he's a failure of a gardener, but he's recording the best season for these things to grow. So I would suggest that to anyone who's starting a garden. It's like, start planting something cheap and easy like lettuce. And just see how early can you push this annually, and which niche in your yard will be best for that crop. It's really cool.
So a selfish question then, am I making a mistake growing 10 varieties of tomatoes? Am I looking at
well, the modern tomato, basically the anthers don't extend past the flower, and they're we're not talking the kinds that haven't been established. You know, any heirloom tomato probably is going to be self-pollinating. So if you talk to Craig LeJulier, who is a tomato expert, he grows, I don't know, 500 kinds of tomatoes on his driveway in a 5-gallon bucket side by side, and they do not basically cross. So you're fine with that. They're really tomatoes that aren't established heirlooms that have been open pollinated for 50 years, which is what you're going to be getting if you buy a seed. Anything that's not, if it's wild tomato, then you have to worry about it.
Thanks very much. You've taken a load off my mind. I appreciate the expert advice.
So Jefferson had many types of gardens. He had orchards, he had vineyards, he had flower gardens, but he had vegetable gardens, including, of course, the great one that you're standing in. He wasn't just growing food the way David Swensen and I do for our private kitchen consumption. How many people were being fed in one way or another out of that garden?
This was not really a garden for the dinner table, although, of course, it produces a quantity, great quantity. Even without the deer fence, one year we had over 2,000 or 3,000 pounds of vegetables served up, and that was just stuff that people recognize. So it's wildly productive. In his day, it was really an experiment of growing all these crops and seeing which ones, you know, were best, most profitable, most productive. He had extensive fields of crops to supply food for his workers, you know, the corn, potatoes. He had a number of grain crops. They were all in the quarter farms. He had 5,000 acres. And so, you know, he had pumpkin patches and turnips. And then he had his demonstrations of field crops like timothy and clover. And so we try to cram all that stuff into this kitchen garden. So we have wheat fields this year. We have cotton. It's going to have five kinds of cotton. We have tobacco.
But I think I hear you saying that the 1,000-foot terraced garden wasn't primarily for immediate consumption. It was a laboratory of gardening experimentation.
Yes, it definitely was a lab. It was kind of like, you know, we have these ag experiment stations today that grow out everything. He's way ahead of his time.
The enslaved people population at Monticello is eating essentially from other sources, their own private plots and from rations that are given to them from the fields and a quantity of pork and so on. But they are not eating from this terraced garden.
No, no. And then he had so many visitors. In a week, he might have 50 to 100 extra people here. And once they're at the top of that Monticello, you know it's not an easy trek to get back down. And in his day, I don't think there are all that many hotels. People just come to, you know, ogle or shake his hand or whatever. And people that he wanted to entertain would stay. And so they'd have these dinners. So he was always purchasing produce from the enslaved gardeners. And he bought cucumbers, cabbage, watermelon, muskmelons, lettuce, strawberries, snap beans, sweet potatoes, peas, onions, chickens, eggs, all this, and more. And they were growing also things that from their culture, like sesame, which Ben Jefferson grew and loved, and the gherkins, cushaw squash, sorghum, all those kinds of things. So it's a huge panoply of plants. So it's all different. What I like to describe is like he had different cultures and climates of vegetables that he was bringing to this garden and trying out.
It's time for us to take just a short break from our conversation with Pat Bradowski, head gardener at Monticello, but we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with or about President Thomas Jefferson. If you've been listening, you know that this week we're having a very special conversation with Pat Bradowski, who is the head gardener at Monticello, and it's just been a pleasure to talk to her.
David, she's talking from the actual garden, the 1,000-foot garden, which is on the south slope of Monticello, made by enslaved labor. And her cell phone cuts out a little bit from now and then, but it's worth it. It's worth it because this is one of our dreams, is to have Pat on site talking from the garden and telling us what she sees around her. And this happened to be a really interesting time because it's Jefferson's birthday and it's Easter weekend. And so they have very large crowds at Monticello. And I was surprised, weren't you? I asked her, how many people who come to Monticello go to the garden? She said, everybody.
That was great.
Everybody.
Well, let's rejoin the conversation and hear more from Pat Brodowski, the head gardener at Monticello.
Pat Clay again. How did it come about that you, who grew up apparently in New York, wound up as a Jeffersonian gardener in Virginia?
Yeah, it's my lifelong quest, of course. Wouldn't you love to be here?
Yes, I'll swap with you.
So, I was, I was in the 4-H. I did a lot of things in New York with horticulture, and then I went to college for horticulture and then agriculture. Then it was really cold. I was in Ithaca. I went to Cornell University. It's very cold there in the winter, and I thought there's got to be a better place to go. So I moved to Baltimore. I went to fine arts school there. And then I moved to Carroll County, Maryland to raise my family. And I got a job at a museum. And part of that was to have a garden. So we had a garden that portrayed vegetables from the 1600s, 1700s, and 1800s. That was terrific. We grew like 150 different heirlooms and portrayed the dinner plate, evolution of the dinner plate. Really fascinating. And then a friend who was writing about patch in the Monticello garden mentioned to him that, well, he lost his gardener, and she mentioned to him that I was a gardener and the job opening would come up, and so I applied. And so I did have a lot of experience and passion for this thing and done a lot of research on different historic topics. And then this garden is much larger, so I started trying to map things out. So, you talk about Jefferson journals. Well, I probably keep up 4 or 5 journals a day, too, because in order to keep up with stuff, you really have to keep careful records. So we have garden plans going back to 2009 so that we can do a 3-year rotation plan for all the produce. Now we're going to have like a soil plan so that we don't introduce pathogens to certain areas. It gets complex, but it's really stimulating.
How long have you been at Monticello?
Since 2009.
Since 2009, so 8 years so far. So I have a question. Something from Peter Hatch's wonderful book on the gardens makes me think that Square 9, that Jefferson's Square 9, has some kind of a special status. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I'm not sure what that means. I'm always concerned about the Pavilion Square, which is Square 11, because it's right in front of the Great Pavilion. Square 9 has the cherry tree, so it's shady, and I guess maybe most people congregate there because it's the shade. So I'm not really sure how important that is. Does grow good carrots, and I'm going to have to research that. I know you have a fascinating Square 9. But
I do. I'll send you what I know about it, but that's what I call my Jeffersonian raised garden in my backyard here in North Dakota. And, of course, still waiting for the big care package from my friend Pat at Monticello. But here's David.
We were talking earlier about seeds and saving and sharing, and I know there's a Dakota connection with Jefferson's gardens and seeds. My understanding is that he had seeds from the Voyage of Discovery.
Sure. So Lewis and Clark sent back with some 10,000 items, and including a lot of seeds. And so we've always had flowers. It was the Mad Dog plant, and we had the prairie flax. And so when Clay visited, we concocted an idea of why don't we exchange seeds as if Jefferson was still here. And so I'd send Jefferson seeds, which are due to Clay this year. And then he would send me seeds from the descendants of the Indian tribes that's helped Lewis and Clark at Fort Mandan.
David, I don't know if you know this story, but when Pat and I first decided to do this East-West exchange, I would be creating Jefferson West, and there would be a little Mandan Hidatsa and a Rikra garden at Monticello. So I sent seeds, and Pat grew them, and she sent seeds, and I grew them. And so then in the fall, I went to the annual Monticello Harvest Festival, and I was so proud. I filled a suitcase with my produce, corn and mandan squashes and Hidatsa beans and a couple of Arikara watermelons and so on. And I went, and I was just thrilled. And we got to this table, and she brought out hers. And my produce was little shrimpy, undergrown, measly. The corn even having all filled out. Everything was undersized and stressed. And she... her table looked like a cornucopia of gardening success.
You quietly took your suitcase and put it in the corner.
I shrank away from Monticello and went over to Poplar Forest and then went to Kentucky and made my way back home. But I was so abashed to see two things, what great soil can do for great seeds, number one, but what a great gardener can do for great seeds. And I felt like a fifth rater in the face of you, Pat. I want a return visit.
I hope I didn't dissuade you from gardening. It's like, but it was so amusing to see these miniature vegetables.
Thank you. Thank you for affirming that. But we need. My goal is to get you out here to spend a week, and we'll find some things for you to do, and I'll take you up to the Mandan Hidatsa and Arikara world, and you can meet native gardeners. You know, there are still people up there in that country, in the Knife River country, who grow traditional Native American, Arikara, Mandan, Hidatsa gardens, and they do it with prayer and with extraordinary ceremonies. And our own David Swenson knows a great deal about some of the corn songs and other songs that were sung by the women who handled those gardens in the bottomlands of the Missouri River. So we need to figure out a way to commit you to coming out here, and maybe we can show you a few things and maybe humble you once or twice.
I doubt that. Pat, I want to thank you so much for giving us being so generous with your time today. And I do hope we can check in with you as the summer progresses and hear more about what's going on at the garden. But before we say goodbye, do you have any dates that would be really good for people to come see the gardens?
Really great times. You know, right now is wonderful. May is really beautiful when all the lettuce are really flush, and, you know, really June when the peas are here. The hot summer, I'm not so sure, but we have a lot of visitors who, you know, have to visit when they can. So we have, you know, I would say every day is beautiful. I would look at the weather and see if you can handle 110 degrees. And then we have a lot of shade on Mulberry Row, so and water stations and so forth. So
pretty much any time is a good time to come visit. Right, okay.
Yeah, even the snow.
For people who are listening to this program around the country and they may live in an apartment complex or may live in a suburban house with a very small amount of land, can you provide some encouraging words about what they can do on a small scale to become Jeffersonian?
Like in a tub on the porch, you know, we grew the Nordic Harm Melon, which is a melon that you can only harvest like exactly like within 2 hours of its ripening. It's fantastically fragrant, and so you really want to keep an eye on it. And it's a very small vine. It's something the person did grow, and it's really ugly, so it's a real conversation piece. But when you cut it open, it's really sweet. So that would grow on a patio. You could grow a tomato up a pole or a bean up a pole. You could grow the Caracalla bean, which is Jefferson calls the most fragrant bean in the world. The beautiful bean in the world has a snail-shaped flower with this Hawaiian tropical scent. You can grow lettuce in a pot or in a window box. I actually had a garden when I was in Baltimore. I had a roof garden, many flower boxes, and I had broccoli and cabbages and onions and endless things. Once you look at a seed catalog, I don't know if you're like me, but it's like, oh, I want this and I want this.
We have had the great joy of having a conversation with Pat Brodowski, the gardener at Monticello, a very good and dear friend of mine and someone who has helped me understand what little I know about gardening. Pat, we so appreciate your willingness to spend some time with us today. We're going to call you in about a fortnight, in about 2 weeks, and see what's different. Take a look around before you go back to the office today and see where things are. And in a couple of weeks, we'll say, what's changed? What's ripe? What's, as Jefferson likes to say, some things work, some things don't. What's healthy and successful this year, and what doesn't look so good? Is that a fair request?
That's marvelous. We'll probably have all kinds of strawberries ripe by then, and maybe some lettuce will be harvested too.
Thanks again for your time. We look forward to talking to you again. It's just been a pleasure.
Yes, I'd love to check in every couple of weeks and let you know what's new, what's working, and what's not working. It'd be really cool. It's been really fun talking to you.
We love you, dear. We'll talk to you next week.
Okay, great. All right.
Bye-bye. Geez, that was fun to talk to her. I think, you know, we're both closet wishers that we were head gardeners at Monticello.
You know, David,
I mean, what she sees every day, what she gets to do every day, a lucky woman.
I thought either one of us was going to sneak out when she mentioned the broad fork. I'm ordering one, and if I can find one, I'll get you one. But this
it's
tool.
It's kind of like a forked spade to me, but it's
yeah, but
not.
It sounds better.
Yeah.
If you can get them, I'm getting a couple for us, because she was saying she's increasingly tilling the ground with a broad fork by hand, and not using the rototilling system that they have been
Before we go to your essay, let's recommend a couple of books if people are interested in this. And I would start with one that you pointed me to. And
The Great Peter Hatch.
Has a book called A Rich Spot of Earth. And it's not only great fun to read, it's great fun to look at.
Magnificent photographs. It's a coffee table book, but well written and insightful. And it is the number one guide to Jefferson the Gardener.
Another one that that I think would be of interest to listeners is Founding Gardeners, a book just recently released by Andrea Wolf, subtitled The Revolutionary Generation, Nature and the Shaping of the American Nation. And
it, long chapter on Jefferson's garden and other founding fathers. But she is an amazing scholar, great writer. If you haven't had a chance to read Founding Gardeners, The Revolutionary Generation, Nature and the Shaping of the American Nation.
A really fun book. Now, sir, it is time for this week's Jefferson Watch.
When I moved back to North Dakota in 2005, I determined to plant a vegetable garden. I moved back to the Great Plains just in case the world collapsed, and when it did, I wanted to be near farm country, where I could, like the Martian, grow just enough potatoes to survive. The moment I got all the boxes into my house, I drove to Fergus Falls, Minnesota, to my grandparents' old dairy farm to get some of their rhubarb. They were long since dead, and the farm now belonged to the city of Fergus Falls, but I managed to dig up a few rhubarb roots before they bulldozed everything and transplanted them back at my house here in Bismarck, North Dakota. For me, this was as important as an ancient Roman transferring the family's household gods, the Lares and the Penates, to the new hearth. I've harvested rhubarb from that seed stock every year since. Every time I bite into a rhubarb pie or rhubarb bars, I think of my grandmother, Rhoda Strauss. She kept a garden all of her life, not as a privileged hobby, but out of actual necessity. As someone who lived through the Depression and the Dust Bowl, she needed to grow as much of her own food as possible every single year, and then to can enough of it to get her family of five through the winter. She's my hero, Rhoda Strauss. She was as close to a Jeffersonian as anyone I have ever met. She paid her taxes, voted every time, belonged to three or four church circles, made quilts, afghans, clothes, draperies, scarves, Christmas decorations, helped to organize the annual Farm Bureau picnic. She had perfect penmanship, spoke and wrote in complete sentences, read all the county brochures on self-improvement, and never borrowed a dime. She was what O.E. Rolvog, quoting the Old Testament, once called a giant in the earth. My mother, who is a remarkable woman, walked away from Jeffersonian agrarianism when she was 18 and never looked back, not once. She wouldn't crochet or make a quilt if you paid her by the inch. When she sees me out weeding my garden or bringing in vast bushels of tomatoes to blanch and can, she can barely hold back a sneer. At her very most generous, mother will say, "Better you than me," and from time to time she explains that farmers' markets are the best of both worlds, high-quality, organic, locally grown food, and somebody else does all the work. But she loves, even covets, my creamed corn, and I have begun counting the frozen bags in my chest freezer before and after she visits. I am not quite sure why I chose to leap over my mother's indifference and back into the arms of my maternal grandmother, but I'm not sorry. My favorite meal of the whole year, whether I dine at my favorite restaurant in front of the Pantheon in Rome or at Delmonico's Steakhouse in Manhattan, comes about August 15th, when I come home from work, walk out into the garden, snap off two cobs of ripe sweet corn, pull three pear-shaped tomatoes off their vines, grab a cucumber, and pull a baseball-sized onion out of the warm earth. I wash them in the kitchen sink, boil the corn, slice up the rest, add a little feta if I'm feeling frisky, and some zesty Italian dressing, and then I eat what I regard as a perfect meal. The taste of this salad to the one you get in a restaurant is the difference of hearing Paul McCartney sing Hey Jude live in concert or listening to the song on an 8-track tape that went through the wash. It is the parable of the mustard seed, Matthew 13:31. It is, in its own humble way, a kind of agrarian declaration of independence. It is to make a sacrament out of the mingling of hands in the soil, modest little seeds, water, and the sun. Farmers are dreamers, and gardeners too. I have big plans for this year's garden. I have been buying and ordering my seeds. Yesterday, after work, I started up my lawnmower, first pull, and my rototiller, 7,000th pull. Then, like Romulus among the seven hills, I made one round with the tiller to claim my precinct and got started. I spent part of the evening trying to decide where to plant what. I will start my tomatoes this weekend inside. This is North Dakota, where you don't dare plant a tomato outside until after Memorial Day, including this year several Joe Cocker tomato seeds given to me by my friends in western Colorado. I'm not even sure what that means, Joe Cocker tomatoes, but I plan to make them flourish with a little help from my friends. I planted potatoes on Good Friday, as the old wives recommend. So where does Jefferson come into this tale of Rhoda Strauss's grandson? I think I speak for my friend David Swenson, the semi-permanent, well, you know what, when I say that Jefferson has changed both of our lives in all sorts of ways, including out in the garden. First, we keep careful records, thanks to the master. Second, we experiment with new crops and new varieties, even when we know that might not work out. Third, we both truly believe that those who labor in the earth are the chosen people of God. And perhaps most of all, we take solace from Jefferson's letter to Charles Wilson Peel on August 20th, 1811. Here's Jefferson. I have often thought that if heaven had given me choice of my position and calling, it should have been on a rich spot of earth, well watered, and near a good market for the productions of the garden. No occupation is so delightful to me as the culture of the earth, and no culture comparable to that of the garden. Such a variety of subjects, some one always coming to perfection, the failure of one thing repaired by the success of another. The failure of one thing repaired by the success of another. If you think about it, this wisdom applies to all of life, not just a vegetable garden up where Lewis and Clark wintered between 1804 and 1805. I'm Clay Jenkinson. We'll see you next week for another exciting edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour is brought to you each week by Dakota Sky Education. The program is distributed nationally by Prairie Public Radio. President Thomas Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. President Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay S. Jenkinson. To obtain a copy of this or any past show for a $12 donation, please call 888-828-2853. Again, that number is 888-828-2853. This program is also available online at jeffersonhour.org and on iTunes. If you'd like to correspond with President Jefferson or submit a question for him to answer on the program, please visit the website at jeffersonhour.org. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Mokoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening. Please tune in again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson.